You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Happy Monday to you. Tom Hartman here with you, greeting my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And our telephone number, 866-987-THOM. And if you'd like a special line for conservatives, 866-745-CONS. Kelvin Ho, is going to be dropping by from Occupy Chicago in about 20 minutes or 15 minutes. And toward the end, Occupy Seattle, Mark Taylor Canfield is going to drop by and let us know what's going on there. A lot going, you know, I realize that sounds like, oh, it's the biggest show ever. Well, every day there's a lot of news, and today is no exception. For example, the Occupy Maine encampment had a bomb thrown into it over the weekend. Now, you may not have heard of this because it was Occupy Maine and not the Maine Tea Party. I keep pointing this out, and I think Americans get it. You know, because the Tea Party movement had the backing of the Koch billionaires and Dick Armey's Freedom Works, you know, multimillionaire lobbyist Dick Armey. They actually had PR firms in New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., high-powered, high-priced, you know, multi-$100 an hour, maybe thousands of dollars an hour, I don't know. But, you know, I know what PR firms cost. They're not cheap. Major PR firms that, you know, basically anything that happened, they made sure that there was a bunch of TV trucks there. And can you imagine if this was a chemical bomb, somebody put it into a Gatorade bottle and rolled it in the middle of the night, rolled it into the Occupy Maine encampment, into the kitchen area where it blew up. And fortunately, there was nobody in that kitchen area, so it blew up a bunch of food and things, but had it gone another, you know, 5-6 feet into where people were sleeping, it could have killed somebody. And the police were quite clear about this. You know, the Occupy Maine folks are in Portland, Maine. They're occupying a 2.5-acre park. And had this happened to the Tea Party, had a bomb gone off at one of Glenn Beck's rallies, we would be hearing, it would be like the hysteria around the Black Panthers on, and I'm both the modern ones that Fox pumped all up where he had these three guys and they pulled up some year-old footage of a guy showing up at a largely Black polling place, an African-American guy in a largely African-American neighborhood with a baseball bat or something that he was holding to his side, like, you know, he was going to keep away, who knows? I mean, the assumption is, and he actually, I mean, you know, he was on my program, he was on RT, he was on others, you know, saying that, you know, he was there to stop people from stopping people from voting. I mean, let's keep in mind the history of this. Back in the 1950s, the way that William Rehnquist, who was rewarded for his loyal service to the Republican Party by being given a seat on the United States Supreme Court, ultimately a chief justice, the way he made his chops was in Phoenix, Arizona, standing at polling places in largely Native American and Hispanic areas, challenging the rights of individuals to vote. And once they were challenged, many of them just went away. Others didn't vote. Others had to turn in provisional ballots because they had been challenged, and the provisional ballots didn't get counted until after the election, and so basically didn't count. So, you know, the Republican Party has this long history of this. There was this woman who was a high school teacher in Florida. And last week, last Thursday or Friday, I mean, the news really came out over the weekend. She was registering her students to vote. She brought in the registration forms and passed them out and said, hey, you want to register to vote? Fill this stuff out. I'll turn it in for you. Turns out that under Rick Scott, the Republicans in Florida passed this draconian law that says you can't register people to vote unless you first register yourself with the state. And then after the people fill in the voter registration forms, if you don't turn them in within a certain number of hours or days, you yourself are subject to criminal penalties. And because she hadn't registered herself with the state and she hadn't turned these in quickly enough, she waited a day or two, however long it was, she's looking at major fines. This is why the League of Women Voters stopped their voter registration drives in the state of Florida. The Republicans basically intimidated them out of it. And it's not just Florida. I mean, this is legislation that probably came out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, this group where corporations pay $100,000 or more to be members to sit side by side with one-third of all the state legislators in the United States, virtually all of them Republicans, who pay $100 a year to be members. And the corporations write legislation, and they vote on whether it will be introduced. They have equal votes with the Republican legislators, and they vote on whether it will be introduced, although the corporations have apparently, if the reports I'm reading are correct, have the ability to stop or veto or pull legislation. So it's basically corporate legislation written by corporate lawyers, written by lobbyists. And then if they all vote on it, then the Republican legislators take it back to their states and introduce it. And that's why there's, you know, the same voter ID law appears in 25 states all at once. And it's always the states that are run by the Republicans. Now, can you imagine if there was a group like that that was writing laws for Democrats to pass, to introduce and pass? And it was funded by, say, George Soros? And this is funded in part by the Koch brothers, ALEC? I mean, it would be all over Fox News all day, every day. They would make sure that it got into the corporate media, into the mainstream media. Most Americans don't even know what ALEC is. Just like most Americans will probably never know that Occupy Wall Street has sustained its first terror attack. That the Occupy Main group had a bomb go off. You know, somebody tried to bomb them. I've been saying this for a long, long time. And let me just, you know, lay it out again. I published an op-ed. You can find it today over at truthout.org and commondreams.org. And, of course, it's my blog for the day at tomhartman.com. But it just hit me over the weekend that the Republicans have always, at least since the 1930s, arguably since the 1880s, but, you know, without getting too technical, basically in the modern era, you know, since Roosevelt. In Roosevelt, the Republicans thought they saw a communist, at least a socialist, which is why a group of, you know, wealthy bankers in Wall Street actually tried to organize a coup. They tried to get Smedley Butler to a physical coup, right? Remove Roosevelt from office. So the Republicans are the party of fear. They used to be afraid of the communists. Then the communists kind of fell apart. I mean, pretty much the only major communists left are in China. And they're not much behaving like communists anymore. So nobody's really afraid of the communists. So, but, you know, they had that going back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, fear of the domino theory and thus Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. And, you know, and frankly, it infected the Democratic Party to some extent. It infected America. I mean, Lyndon Johnson with his war in Vietnam. But, you know, that was in response in large part to the Republican drumbeat. He felt like he had to take a stand against communism or he couldn't get elected. And then, you know, Nixon carried it on. Joe McCarthy's hearings, the blacklist, Ronald Reagan informing on his fellow members of SAG, the Screen Actors Guild. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. So then after 9/11, I mean, you know, the Republicans didn't have communists to be afraid of anymore. So then it was radical Muslims. And then Barack Obama comes along and kills bin Laden. So what are they going to be afraid of now? I got to tell you how this all works, how they put this thing together, and why it is canceling out both parties right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Actually, after this, up next, Kevin Hoff from Occupy Chicago. 130 arrests in Chicago. You cannot win. You may throw me down, but I'll rise again. The more you say, the more I defy you. So get out of my face. Whoa, yeah. Whoa. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And, wow, 130 arrests? I mean, is it possible? Kelvin Ho is with us. He is the press liaison with Occupy Chicago, OccupyShy.org, the website. Kelvin, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. 130 arrests. Tell us what happened.
So what happened was that we had another mass mobilization Saturday in order to make another attempt to set up a formal 24/7 occupation. It was decided by the General Assembly that this would be at the Bowman statue on Congress in Michigan. And we had about, I think, 4,000, 5,000 people show up, and eventually 130 people had to stay and remain in the park after the police threatened us with arrest.
Wow. First of all, I've got your name spelled in two different ways in two different places. Is there an A in it, or an L rather, as in Kelvin, or K? Is it
Kelvin with an E and a K?
Yeah. But with no L?
With an L.
Oh, with an L. Okay, great. Kelvin, my apologies. I just want to get it right. Okay, so beyond that, what else is going on in Chicago?
Well, so immediately after that, the 130 people were taken to the local prison, and this time they were held for much, much longer and went through much harder conditions than the 175 or so that were arrested last Saturday.
Hmm.
As a result of this, the National Nurses United, of which I believe at least two of their members were there with us Saturday, and they're among the last to be released. And so this morning, Occupy Chicago, along with National Nurses United, have organized a rally at the City Hall to let Mayor Rahm Emanuel know that we will not stand for the sort of conditions that our people were subjected to on Saturday, and to also show that we will continue to exercise our rights to assemble and voice our grievances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, National Nurses United has just been spectacular in so many areas. I mean, here's a group of nurses who are calling for a transaction tax, a securities transaction tax, basically a speculator tax, as a way of throwing sand into the gears of Wall Street, and so it's the perfect liaison with the Occupy Wall Street, Occupy Chicago, Occupy other movements. I noticed that there were 11 arrests in Cincinnati. Do you have any other information on other Midwestern events that are happening?
I'm personally unfamiliar with what the Midwestern events are, what other sorts of events are happening here in the Midwest. But I do know that there's beginning to be much more coordinated effort across all occupied movements around the nation to coordinate much larger scale joint action. And a lot of ideas have been floating around.
Okay.
And that would not only include the Midwest, but all of these occupations that are happening nationwide.
Great. Kelvin, thank you so much for the update, and keep up the great work, and give our very best regards to everybody there, please.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Great to have you on with us. Chris in Minneapolis, Occupy Minnesota.
Hi.
Hey, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to state that we had passed a resolution saying, resolved that the General Assembly of Occupy Minnesota orders that Congress introduce an amendment to the United States Constitution to end corporate personhood, effectively stating that corporations are not people and money is not speech.
Wow. So, still my beating heart. My mantra.
It was. You got yourself to thank for it.
That is great. That is great. Chris, thank you for you just made my day. This is the cancer at the core of everything. Everything else is a metastasis from it. Is this these series of Supreme Court decisions over the years that have led to this final fulminating doctrine that corporations are people and money is speech, and that has turned American democracy, to the extent that we had something that was a genuine democracy, into a kleptocracy, into a plutocracy, into a corporatocracy, into, you know, you name it, an oligopoly, you know, et cetera. And that is marvelous. Everything going okay in Minnesota?
Well, we're working on some other things here. I'm hoping that we can work on something about public banking or a public option for banking.
Yeah, well, you have one in credit unions, you know.
Because
credit unions are owned by their depositors, as opposed to community banks or national banks, which are owned by their stockholders. So that.
Well, I'm hoping for some interest-free loans for public infrastructure and things like that.
Well, for that you need really a state bank. For that, you know, what Illinois needs to do is what North Dakota did, which is incorporate a state bank. And then the state bank can create money and loan it to the state and then pay it back at no interest. I mean, it's conceivable that they can loan themselves money at no interest. Or if it's at a very low interest, then, you know, the profit then goes into the coffers of the state. It's one of the reasons why North Dakota has a very low unemployment rate. They've done very well. It's one of the reasons why the California State Assembly right now is seriously considering the possibility of creating a California State Bank. And it's one of the reasons why the big banks, these six banks who own assets equal to 65% of our entire national GDP, are out in California lobbying individual legislators like there's no tomorrow to keep that from happening. But that's how to make it happen, is to have a state bank in Illinois. In Minnesota. Chris, thanks so much for the call, and good luck. Keep up the great work. Give my very, very best to everybody there at Occupy Minnesota.
Take it easy.
Yeah, you too. Do good. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how did the Republicans force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus, and why is it that the Republicans are basically lost in the wilderness? I'll explain right after this. Okay, so here's how it works. This is the Republicans have historically been the party of, you know, gifts to the rich, but quietly. Like during the Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover administrations of the 1920s, they kind of proudly, you know, wore the monocle and the three-piece suit with the gold chain and the watch and the large belly, as it were, you know, the kind of classical rich guy suit. But since the Great Depression, since the Great Crash in 1929 and the election of Roosevelt in 32, the Republicans have been fairly quiet about the fact that they're really only about the 1%. And to get the 99% to go along with them, or at least 50% of the 99%, so that they would vote for them in things like presidential elections, what Republicans have done is they have resorted to selling fear. Fear that your gun is going to be taken away from you. Fear that gay people are going to fill in the blank. I don't know. Imagine your fear. Gay people are coming after your kids. Gay people are coming after your wife. Gay people are coming after you. I mean, basically appealing to homophobia. The fear of people of color. Fear of immigrants. They're going to take your job. Fear of, you know, Pat Buchanan's new book out. It's got a chapter, you know, The Death of White America. What? And so anyhow, they've been peddling fear, and they actually had a big one. For the better part of 40 years, worked pretty well for them, which was the communists, specifically the Soviet communists, the USSR. Because Khrushchev, you know, famously said, you know, we will bury you. Now, the context of that got lost decades ago. What he was talking about was economically, and it was, you know, when he kind of lost it with Richard Nixon at the, as I recall, at the World's Fair, and you know, but in any case, he, you know, economically, we will bury you, and that got turned into we will, you know, we've got enough nukes that we're going to turn you into a pile of rubble and dirt and blah, blah, blah. And the Republicans believed this, and they got their people believing this, and a lot of Americans believed it. And so when they came along and they said, and, you know, if we don't stop them in Vietnam, then next they'll be in Laos and then in Cambodia because, you know, China wants the whole region, and pretty soon it'll be Thailand and then the Philippines and then Hawaii, and then next to go is Los Angeles and San Francisco. The old domino theory. And so the Republicans have always been, you know, they've had this, you know, be afraid. They're going to take away your guns. The gays are going to get you. They've got a war on Christmas. They're trying to take God out of America. Bill O'Reilly's been leading this charge for years on Fox so-called News, also known as GOP TV. And communism fell apart. So then, you know, like a gift out of heaven, 9/11 happens, and the Republicans all of a sudden, they've got something brand new to be afraid of. Radical Islam, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. Now, in 2003, suddenly, for some inexplicable reason, George W. Bush started saying, I don't care about him. I don't think much about him. You know, he's, you know, it's no big deal. Now, why would he do that? The reason that George Bush did that was the same reason the Republicans campaigned on making abortion illegal and then never made it illegal. Because they need it out there legal so that they can tell that single issue voter niche, we're your guys. Vote for us. We'll get you what you want. It's the same reason why the Republicans. I mean, time after time, you know, we're going to do something about the Soviet Union. Never quite did. We're going to do something about, we're going to make sure that there's an amendment to the Constitution that says that you can't have gun control laws, or there's going to be an amendment to the Constitution that says that abortion is illegal. You know, life begins at consent. There's going to be, and they never do it. And so when George W. Bush started saying, I don't think so much about Osama bin Laden, there was a logic to that. He needed bin Laden out there so that they could keep the war going against him. It was all they had. So President Obama comes along and he kills bin Laden. And now the Republicans are like, uh-oh, what are we going to do now? Maybe we can make people afraid of Iran. But it's not selling. But they do have a fallback. Back in the 1970s, Jude Winninski, this Republican strategist, came up with two things. Back in the 1970s, around 1976, he invented the phrase supply-side economics. Jude was a journalist. He had a degree in journalism, but he thought of himself as an economist. In fact, often he was introduced when he was a guest on radio TV shows as an economist. He was not. He was a journalist. He was really a Republican strategist. But anyhow, he invented this phrase, supply-side economics, and the philosophy that goes along with it, which was immediately glommed onto by the Republicans. And he came up with this proposal that the Democrats had always been Santa Claus in America by giving away things to the American people like the 40-hour work week and safe working conditions and Pure Food Acts and Safe Drug Acts, and by creating the USDA and the FDA and reasonable working hours in the Department of Labor and the right to unionize and weekends and Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And, I mean, you know, the list goes on and on and on. All of those things came about as the result of Democrats. And in every single case, the Republicans fought them like crazy. You know, just said no. Excuse me. William F. Buckley famously said, "A conservative is a man who stands astride the arc of history with his arm out, shouting stop." And that's what the Republicans have been doing. And Winninski pointed this out, and he said, "You know, we Republicans have been the party of no to Santa Claus, He said, we need to become Santa Claus, and at the same time, we need to stop the Democrats from being Santa Claus. In fact, to use Wininsky's phrase, we need to force the Democrats to shoot Santa. The Santa that they themselves created. And the way to do that is whenever a Republican comes into office, spend money like crazy and run up a massive debt. Now, two good things come out of that from a Republican point of view. First of all, by spending money like crazy, it you create a financial bubble. It makes it, you know, even today I had both Stephen Moore and Phil Kirpin on my show last week. Stephen Moore of the Wall Street Journal, Phil Kirpin of Americans for Prosperity, and both of them went out of their way to talk about how, well, you know, millions of jobs are created during the Reagan administration. See, you give me a $3 trillion credit card that nobody's paying for, maybe my grandchildren, I can show you what it looks like to live large. So anyhow, the first part of this was spend like a drunken sailor. No offense to drunken sailors. And put it on the national credit card. So the first benefit was that they actually stimulated the economy in a classical Keynesian fashion. Reagan did this, Bush 1 did this, and Bush 2 did this I was going to use the old poker phrase in spades, but it even goes beyond that. It was like on steroids or something. You know, pick your cliche. I mean, he ran a $5 trillion in debt and spent it all. George W. Bush. The ultimate Keynes stimulus, but it wasn't even Keynes, it wasn't rational Keynes stimulus. It was bubble stimulus, and it stretched the bubble so far that it popped in 2008. So anyhow, that was half of the thing. You know, the Republicans need to be the Santa Clauses of tax cuts and spending. So spend like crazy. Don't call a lot of attention to it, but do it. And give away tax cuts, and people will start thinking of you as Santa Claus. And then run up a big enough debt that whenever a Democratic president comes into power, then you start screaming about the debt bomb. And put up debt clocks in New York City. And every show, mention the debt and talk about the debt. And when Bill Clinton became president, they forced him to shoot the Santa Claus of welfare and to end big government as we know it. And now with Barack Obama, they're getting him to actually talk about shooting the Santa Claus of Medicare. They're very happy about this, but the Democrats have figured this out, or at least in the last few months, the Democrats have figured this out. And so Obama's trying to be Santa Claus again. He's saying, hey, you know, we want to put people back to work. We're going to do a jobs program. We're going to tax the very rich, people with incomes over $1 million. We're going to take that money. We're going to put 400,000 people back to work. And he's forcing the Republicans to say no. He's taking us back to pre-Reagan, to the classic dynamic of the Republicans being the party of no and the Democrats being the party of Santa Claus. And frankly, I think, you know, if he does it successfully, it may well work. Harry Reid is going to bring another bill to the Congress that taxes the top millionaire people over $1 million, 0.7%. To rebuild our roads.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Let's check in with Mark Taylor Canfield. What's going on with Occupy Seattle as well, right after this? End your call. OccupySeattle.org. Mark Canfield, Taylor Canfield is with us, back with us. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for allowing us to get some of this information out to the public.
My pleasure. Last time we talked, I believe it was you I was talking with, right?
Correct.
Okay. Last time we talked, you were talking about how the Seattle Police Department was giving drivers tickets for honking, hey, you know, good on you. A female protester was arrested for having an umbrella, that was a structure. I understand that they have since allowed you to have some kind of a tent or structure. Somebody was busted for graffiti of a chalk drawing of a clenched fist. What's going on?
Well, there seems to be a systematic camp- campaign of intimidation. I mean, I think they just wanted to get us out of the park. And what we need is a good team of civil rights attorneys who can go before a judge and file an injunction against some of these, what I would say, politically motivated attacks on our freedom of speech and assembly. And I realize that this is also going on in cities and towns all across the country, in places like Denver and San Francisco.
It is.
But in Seattle, it's been very puzzling because the mayor keeps making these declarations of support. But meanwhile, they're basically harassing everyone in the park and trying to get us to leave. And there's a series of, you know, constitutional issues here. When they are confiscating people's property and taking their signs and their backpacks and their tents and, you know, their private property, you know, that I would say is a violation of our protection against unlawful search and seizure. And the fact that they're actually selectively enforcing the park rules to specifically target protesters, including moving right into the middle of the crowd during a general assembly and arresting people. In that case, it was actually a Native American man who was praying on a blanket. I mean, when they do things like that, it's obviously, you know, a violation of our freedom of speech. That was happening during regular park hours.
Why would they arrest a guy praying on a blanket?
Well, okay, so they're interpreting the park rules, which is actually part of a city ordinance, that prohibits any kind of camping, and along with that, there are restrictions on any kind of camping equipment, or sleeping equipment. So any kind of sleeping bag,
the blanket qualifies as that he was praying on.
Well, although the next day during an anti-police brutality march and rally, a friend of mine sat there on a blanket for, you know, an hour, and no police officer asked him to remove the blanket. So okay. I'm just saying it seems to be selective enforcement, and there are lawsuits potential here. And I'm just saying, you know, if the mayor really supports us, as he states, then he needs to rein in the police and allow our constitutional rights to petition the government for redress of grievances, because this is pretty outrageous.
Yep. I'm with you. Well, Mark, OccupySeattle.org, of course, the website. Hopefully some of our listeners in Seattle will call the mayor's office and say hi.
I would highly recommend that. Yeah, tell him what you think, because he, you know, got a lot of votes from people who support us. So politically, this could be difficult for him.
Yep. And once again, the physical area, the park that you guys are in, where is that?
It's at Westlake Park, which is at 4th and Pine. It's right downtown at Westlake Center.
Okay, great. Mark, thanks a lot for being with us again and for the report.
Well, you know, we need to make this a national movement. That means we need to stay in our occupations, because as cities all working together, we can be really effective. I believe that, and I'm working for that.
I think we're already there. And it's just getting bigger and bigger and more and more. And you're a great piece of it. Mark, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Good talk with you. Let's see here. Ken in Phoenix. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Yes, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. On Saturday, I attended a town hall meeting with my Republican representative, Trent Franks, and I wanted to give you a report.
Okay.
He took questions, written questions, which I wrote down. Would you support an amendment to say that corporations are not people, and speech is not money?
Right.
Of course, he didn't read my question.
Right.
But then he opened it up, and I got the chance to stand and ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get some applause from the audience.
Huh?
And he just looked at, what are you talking about?
Oh, my. Well, you know, he's a Republican. I mean, that's the way it's got to be. Ken, thanks for the info on that. I appreciate that. Bob in Irvine. Hey, Bob, what's up?
No, actually, it's Paul. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Yeah. I'm asking your screener, where is the Tea Party? Why aren't they joining the Occupy Wall Street? I mean, I know they're bussed in by the Koch brothers, but they're not there. They're not out there.
I think they might be. You know, and what causes me to think this is that, you know, first of all, the last big Tea Party meeting that the Tea Party tried to organize was in St. Louis about, I don't know, a month and a half ago. And they were expecting hundreds of people. And I don't know if you saw the photo, but there were three people, one speaker and two people sitting in the chairs in the hundreds of chairs. So that literally three people showed up in St. Louis for this Tea Party movement. So I think that at the grassroots level, at the level of, you know, just the average person who used to be showing up at the Tea Party movement because they're mad as hell and they're not going to take it anymore, but they're not sure exactly what they're mad at, but they know that things are wrong and they know that the banksters ripped us off. Those people aren't showing up at Tea Party meetings anymore. And I think that some fraction of those people, because they're certainly calling into this show and self-identifying, some fraction of those people are actually showing up at the Occupy Wall Street groups all around the country. And you know, they're not raising their hands and saying, oh, hi, I used to be a Tea Partier. I mean, that might get you a few dirty looks. But I think that what you're looking at is the rise of raw populism, you know, right across the board. People saying, you know, it's this Howard Beale moment in American history. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And you know, we can make some specific demands. We could go through the long list of grievances like Thomas Jefferson did with the Declaration of Independence. But, you know, that was preceded by 3 years of things like the Boston Tea Party and the Boston Massacre and the committees of correspondence and on and on. You know, it's a lot led up to the actual Declaration of Independence. And
you know what I was probably thinking about, Tom, was that the incarnation of American for Prosperity busing in what's known as the Tea Party, what we know as the modern Tea Party.
Right. Well, they're not gonna do that. They're not gonna take those $300,000 buses and say, hey, Tea Partiers, let's go down to the Occupy Wall Street, because that's run by Dick Armey and a bunch of lobbyists. I mean, that ain't gonna happen. But I think that the people who are falling for the Tea Party stuff now get it, that the Tea Party stuff was grassroots and you guys are the real, or was AstroTurf rather, and you guys are the real grassroots. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. We have been talking about how the Republicans' strategy since 1976, really since it was put into place in 81 with the Reagan presidency, to force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus, a.k.a. Social Security, Medicare, unemployment insurance, things like that, and to have something to be afraid of, very afraid of, is kind of hitting a peak. I think this is a fact. I wrote an op-ed about it this weekend. That basically, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Republican Party's got nothing, right? Or they had nothing, at least until 9/11. And I think that in part explains why George W. Bush went into the, you know, after he was given the presidency by the Supreme Court, his poll numbers just stunk. I mean, it was like nothing was going on. And then suddenly 9/11 happens, and all of a sudden the Republicans have got something new to be afraid of. Radical Islam. Well, now President Obama kills bin Laden, and you can't be so afraid of radical Islam anymore. And then on top of that, Obama goes over to Egypt and gives a tear down these dictators speech. And the Arab Spring happens, and they tear down the dictators. They voted in Tunisia yesterday. You know, Gaddafi was you know, for better or for worse. I'm ambivalent about this, but you know, he's dead. Apparently, at the hands of his own citizens. So, you know, what are the Republicans going to do? They got nothing to be afraid of. I mean, they're trying. Look at the Republican debates. We need to be afraid of brown people, those immigrants. We need a fence. No, we need an electric fence. No, we need two electric fences with sand in between and dogs and watchtowers. And wait a minute, isn't that what it looked like between East and West Germany? Yes, that's what we need, yes. Because they were very afraid, too. But that's a whole different thing. That was to keep the East Germans in, not to keep the West Germans out. You think? To some extent, yeah, but have you noticed how our passports now have little RFID chips in them? And there's this no-fly list? And, you know, try going to Cuba. You think we're not being kept in some regards? Well, yeah, you know, if you got the money, you can go play tourist someplace. But show up in Canada with a bunch of furniture. Actually, Louise and I did this once. When we moved down to Detroit, down in the 70s. It's when Louise was pregnant with our oldest child. And we had this van, this step van, this Chevy step van. It had two seats in the front and the back was completely empty. It was, we had owned a TV repair shop, and I used to use it to haul, you know, stuff that I was going to fix around in it, electronic equipment. So we moved down to Detroit, and I still had, and we had moved into this house that we rented, and I still had in Westland, by Inkster, down in the western, near the airport, actually. The planes came right down over our house for one of the landing patterns. And so anyhow, I still had a bunch of the stuff in the back of the van that we hadn't unloaded into the house. In part, one of it was a big desk that I had to like take apart to get into the house, and I hadn't gotten around to it yet. And so there was some furniture in the back of the van, and we wanted to go over to Windsor, the town across the way from Detroit, to have lunch, because there's some cool restaurants over there, and we were just going to go over and have a nice dinner together. And yeah, we'd kind of saved up for weeks, actually, for it. We barely had two nickels back then. And we get to the border, and the Canadian border, the woman who was the Canadian border person, you know, she leans over and she looks at my truck and she says, "You got furniture in the back." And she looks at Louise and goes, "And you're pregnant." And we said, "Yes." And she says, "You can't come into Canada. We're not going to let you in." And I'm like, "We're just going for dinner." And she's like, "Right. We've heard that before." And, I mean, this wasn't even during the Vietnam War. I mean, this was, you know, long after Jerry Ford had, I think. In any case, she sent us back. But I digress. The point is that the Republicans are lost, and the Democrats are, you know, they're slowly getting their mojo back. And frankly, this is that opportunity, that moment in time where the Democratic Socialists of America and the Green Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement and the grassroots organizations like Move On and Progressive Democrats of America and Democracy for America and whatnot, Code Pink, we had Medea on our program last week. All of these groups should collectively be moving in the direction of what Jude Waninski referred to as Santa Claus. He called it Santa Claus. I would call it a we society, to borrow a phrase from Michael Moore's movie Sicko, where he said words to the effect of, ultimately, at some point, Americans are going to have to answer the question, are we going to be a me society or a we society? Are we going to be a libertarian, selfish, 1% society? Or are we going to be an egalitarian, democratic, socialist, big D Democrat? You know, pick your label. Green, Occupy, whatever. Are we going to be a we society where we're all in this together? Where everybody's voice is heard? You know, what kind of society are we going to be ultimately? And we're at one of those moments in history, and frankly, I'm very encouraged by two things that are simultaneously happening. One is the Occupy movements all across the country are, you know, picking up steam. And the movement at the same time, actually several things, at the same time, the movement to push back on corporate power is picking up steam. And at the same time, the Democratic Party, the Republican, or the president, and I, you know, you've heard me criticize the president in the past. At the same time, I think that he's done a fair amount of good stuff. Nobody's perfect, right? There's no politician that we're all going to agree with. But net, particularly given that the Supreme Court is at stake, this is the guy that I would like to be president for another 4 years. And I think that he I was very encouraged by Ron Suskind, who spent a fair amount of time with him in the White House, who said if he gets reelected, the Times will force him to be, but his inclination was to be anyway. He just had advisors around him who sabotaged him to become that Franklin Roosevelt that we need right now. So anyhow, what he's doing is he's coming out and saying, I'm trying to be Santa Claus, or I'm trying to create a wee society. I mean, last week it was, let's put 400,000 teachers, cops, and firefighters back to work by giving $35 billion to the states, by taxing people who earn more than $1 million a year, one half of 1% on their million and first dollar. Don't raise taxes at all on the first $1 million a year somebody makes. Half a percent after that. Now, keep in mind, Bill Clinton's taxes were 3% higher on people making over a couple $100,000 a year. And before Ronald Reagan came in, it was 74% on people making the equivalent in today's dollars of maybe $1 million a year. And the Republicans said no. And so what? And now the president is going to do it by executive order. I think this is kind of cool. I'm encouraged.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I see this incredible confluence. Let's check in with Joseph Hansen, United Food and Commercial Workers. Some very interesting activities going on here.
Big company, sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, the place where we are willing to say, is Walmart a person? And we are willing to say, no, not a chance. Speaking of which, Joseph Hansen is with us. He is the president of the United Food and Commercial Workers, UFCW International Union, the website ufcw.org, of course. And Joseph, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. I'm glad to be on.
Tell us what's going on with Walmart.
Well, it's kind of an amazing story. The richest, biggest corporation in the world unleashes its attack on its own workers and employees, who I think are defenseless on this deal, and completely goes against the grain of what's going on in this country. One section of our economy that has been fairly stable and growing, although it's at the bottom of the scale, has been the service economy and retail food, and there's been millions of workers in that section. And then what Walmart just did last week to take away the health care from future Walmart employees that are part-time, which is the majority of their workers, and cut back, I think it's unconscionable.
Let's just recap this for people who don't know what we're talking about. Let's recap this, Joseph, for people who don't know what we're talking about. Walmart. You started out by saying, you know, Walmart's further screwing their workers. Basically, my language, not yours. I think most people think that Walmart workers already were the most screwed in America. But the fact of the matter is that Walmart was offering some small measure, albeit it was too costly for many of their workers to take, but a small measure of employee benefit. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah, if they could afford to take it, and then if they could afford to pay the deductibles on top of it.
So right, so it was basically...
It was something, but damn little.
Yeah, it was a high-deductible health insurance. It was basically a catastrophic illness and health insurance policy,
right,
that if you got, you know, cancer or something and you could afford to pay the first X tens of thousands or thousands or whatever it is, then, you know, it covered you, and you had to pay for it out of your paycheck. And a lot of people actually were taking jobs with Walmart just to get that policy, because there was no other way to get that kind of policy. And now Walmart has changed their policy on the policy. So explain that to us.
Well, it's hard to explain. I really can't understand it myself. This is a company that's very profitable. They get profits from all around the world, and then to take it away from people who can afford to lose it the least, it just makes no sense at all, and it goes against the grain of what's going on in this country. There was a national debate for years about trying to change our health care system, which ended up with a health care act that I would be the first to admit that it's flawed, but it does go toward coverage towards the majority of people and the people that can't afford it.
Right.
And here's the biggest corporation just setting just a very poor example, and I can't explain it, Tom. It just makes no good sense, except if it's just pure greed. You know, if the Walton family wants to take more money and put it in their pocket at the expense of their own workers, that's the only explanation I can come up with.
So, in essence, what they're saying, what the Walmart Corporation is saying to their employees, because they typically do hire people for 30 or 35 hours or less wherever they hire them, depending on the state, because that way they consider them part-time employees, and part-time employees don't automatically qualify for benefits in those states where it's required that if you give benefits to any full-time employees, you have to give it to all your full-time employees. So first of all, they've got all these part-time people who are working 30 hours a week. And now, and those people used to be eligible to buy into that health insurance plan, even though it might cut, you know, consume a large chunk of their paycheck. What they're saying now is that future employees will not be able to buy into that health insurance plan. Do I have that right?
Well, what they're doing is, the way I understand it from their own release, is that any new employees who work less than 24 hours a week will not be able to get health insurance. And that's completely in their control.
They, okay.
You know, it's very easy for Walmart to schedule you 23 and a half hours, and
yep.
And then you really are screwed.
So that's going to become the new normal at Walmart, probably, is 23 and a half hours.
Unfortunately, it's pretty close to the new normal right now. It's hard for Walmart workers, and we have contact with thousands and thousands of them in our Walmart campaign, and we hear stories right from the people that work at Walmart, and it's very rare to find people that are getting more than 30 hours, and it's completely in the management's control to keep them under there, so then they won't have any ability to get health insurance.
Wow. Wow.
You look for big corporations to set a positive example.
Well, I was going to take it to that. We're talking with Joseph Hansen, the president of the UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers. Is this Walmart leading the new normal, and they will be followed by the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and the Yummy Foods and, you know, all these other retailers and for that matter the product retailers, Toys R Us and whatnot? Or are they following others who have already blazed this path?
Well, they're so big,
it's
hard to believe that they won't have an impact on the other competitors. Our union, the UFCW, represents hundreds of thousands of part-time workers, and we're proud of the fact that we do negotiate health care with decent-sized companies, big companies, Safeway, Kroger Company, companies throughout all California, all the way across the country, Super Value and other big corporations and small ones. And, you know, and the companies understand they have a moral consideration for their own employees, which apparently is missing in the whole Walmart makeup.
Well, things have really changed in America. I remember 20, 30, 40, well, no, I don't know, 30 years ago anyway. When a company would lay off people, or when a company would start cutting back on benefits to people, everybody would start getting worried. You know, there'd be stories in the business press about, is this company in trouble? Is this company going out of business? Has the management gone insane? And now when companies start doing that, their stock price goes up.
Yeah. Well, I think that leads to even a bigger question, and that's why you're seeing what you're seeing with the Occupy Wall Street. It could be Occupy Walmart,
quite frankly.
There is a frustration and a concern growing in this country. This is not right. We cannot keep taking advantage of people on the lower end of the spectrum and putting it all in the pockets of the top 1%. We're the other 99%.
There you go. That's very, very well said. Joseph Hansen, president of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, UFCW.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more about Santa Claus and your thoughts right after this.
Oh, start your sweatshop labor in a foreign factory, and gets packed on a vessel and shipped over the sea.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And the first official terrorist, active terrorism directed against the Occupy movements happened over the weekend in Portland, Maine. The Occupy Maine folks were asleep, and somebody put a chemical bomb in a Gatorade bottle, rolled it into their food tent. The thing blew up. Fortunately, there was nobody in there, no human being in there. It blew up the tent pretty badly. And had there been a person there, they may have been maimed, injured, or even killed. So the question that I pose to you, and I want you to be thinking about this as you scan the news, as you watch the network news tonight, as if you do, as you watch, you know, take a look at Fox, take a look at CNN, take a look at MSNBC, whatever it may be, as you watch the news, as you listen to the news on your local radio station, as you read your newspapers. And this is not so much an indictment of all those as it is an explanation of how this works. Dick Armey and the Koch brothers, when they put together this AstroTurf Tea Party movement where they would buy big sound stages and jumbotrons and buses and paint the bus, you know, these $150,000, $300,000 buses and give them a $100,000 paint job and bus people in from all over for the Tea Party events. They had full-time PR agencies operating out of Los Angeles, New York, and Washington, D.C. that in aggregate probably cost millions of dollars over the course of the life of the Tea Party. And therefore, anything that happened relative to the Tea Party made its way into the newscasts, the TV casts, the radio newscasts, the newspapers, all of that stuff. So in that context, just ask yourself this question. If there had been a Tea Party meeting in St. Louis, Missouri, I mean, that's actually the last one that I know of where they tried to do one. Only three people showed up. They've pretty much stopped having Tea Party meetings because nobody shows up to them anymore. But this was the last one that was put on by one of the actual groups that gets the money and all that kind of thing. And they had all, you know, hundreds of chairs out and the whole stage and the jumbotrons and the speakers. And three people showed up, the speaker and two people in the audience. It looked like a husband and wife. And amidst this sea of empty chairs, had, God forbid, a chemical bomb gone off at a Tea Party event, and nobody was hurt, but could have been, what would the coverage be like? And how much coverage is this first terrorist act against the Occupy movement going to get? Lacking full-time PR firms on both coasts in three of America's major cities and media centers. I mean, you heard it here, but where's it going to go? Anthony in Detroit. Hey, Anthony, you've got an Occupy Detroit and Occupy Windsor update for us?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Yes. This past Saturday, the occupiers, which I was a part of, we walked from our camp to the foot of Woodward Hard Plaza, which you're probably familiar with in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's a river that separates Canada and the U.S. of A. Detroit.
Yeah, it's the border I was talking about earlier, where Louise and I showed up with her pregnant and me with a van full of furniture, and we were just going to go over to Windsor for dinner, and they turned us back because they thought we were trying to sneak into the country.
Yes, it is not even 5 miles across. I think it's a couple of miles, if that. And we was able to connect in solidarity with them, you know, through our voices in unison, where it was amplified. They can hear us. And we also was able to hear them, and they was chanting, "We are the 99ers as well."
This is Occupy Windsor, the Canadians, and Occupy Detroit, the Americans, on either side of the river.
That's right.
That's spectacular.
We was able to see the signs, you know, not read them, of course, but we could tell they had signs up.
Yeah.
And we had a telephone connection with one of the occupiers over there, and one of our workers on our side was speaking to him, and, you know, we kind of talked about what we was going to say, and we all said it together, and we stood down there for about 20 minutes to half an hour, and it was quite a few people. It was enough that you could see the mass of people on the other side of the river that it was a crawl, you know, it was a lot of folks over there.
Sure.
So it was like a historical, felt like a historical moment. You
yeah.
know?
And not just an historic, however you want to say it. Anyway, not just an historic American moment, but an international moment.
Right.
And you know, yeah, that's great. Anthony, thank you so much for calling and sharing that with us. Perry, in Huntington, West Virginia, you have an Occupy Huntington, West Virginia report?
Yeah, it's thunder and lightning out here, and everybody's out here in Huntington, West Virginia, in front of the Citibank.
Oh, really?
Just holding our own. Just wanted to shout out.
Okay. Well, thank you for the shout out, and thank you for Pat. You know, hopefully we've passed along your shout out to other people who might be able to show up in Huntington, West Virginia at the Citibank, you said?
Yeah, the Citibank of Fifth Avenue there, and I think everybody's really tired of this economy, and I think that we're going to see the infancy of a revolution to get the thing done right the way things are supposed to be done.
I believe you're right. As long as we're not talking about guns, I'm absolutely believe you're right, Perry.
Oh, the peaceful revolution.
Yeah, peaceful. There you go, Perry. Thank you very much for the call and for the report. And Sally in Seattle, you've got some Occupy Seattle information.
Oh, not actual information, but just something old grandmothers think about. You had the Occupy Seattle person, and it's much more information than I do. I stop by, and they have such needs there. It's not only the police, but they're in a park district, so security can come and take their things. The man I was talking to last week just had the clothes on his back. So they are in desperate need again of blankets and sweaters and hot cups, toothpaste, all those kinds of things, razors, disposable razors, vitamin C, multivitamins, because now they're all catching cold. So all my fellow Seattle people, let's face it, it's West Coast, campers, skiers, bring your old stuff there. And as you're passing by to get to Nordstrom's and Macy's, which you have to do in order to get there, bring them something.
Okay. Well said. Well said, Sally. Thank you very much for the call. And
thank you.
Much appreciated. Jim in Somerdale, Ohio. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I thank you for your show, man. It's great you're waking everybody up and bringing it their awareness.
But
I disagree with the UFCW guy. I was a member of the union for many years in the 80s, and I saw this change in it. You know, back in the day when unions were strong, they've actually shriveled up that union. It doesn't really...
You know, when Ronald Reagan came into office, about a third of all Americans were unionized. Now, in the private sector, it's 8%. That is not the result of a decision that the unions made.
Yeah, I know, but it's the corporate America that's controlling these unions, basically. I saw
it is,
like...
It is a consequence of a change in laws. Yes, absolutely. The Department of Labor was brought into being in 1935 by the Wagner Act during the Roosevelt administration, and its specific mandate is to defend the interests of labor. I mean, it's right in the enabling legislation. And when Ronald Reagan became president, he stocked and stacked the Department of Labor with people who were actively hostile to labor, and the Department of Labor stopped defending the rights of labor, and they even went so far as to publish a pamphlet on how to outsource to other countries and how to basically scare employees into not voting for a union by threatening to outsource to other countries. This is our Department of Labor did this under the Reagan and Bush administrations. And so what you've seen, and then on top of that, of course, the international trade agreements, which made it really, really easy to execute that threat. And the consequence of that has been that our labor unions have become a shadow of what they were. But it's still a shadow that's trying to be present. It's still a shadow that's speaking out. And frankly, you know, now that many of the unions, for example, with Working America, workingamerica.org, which the AFL-CIO put together for people who don't have a workplace where they can unionize and they can still be part of the union movement. And, you know, there's no dues or anything. You just show up.
Yeah, but there's strong unions and weaker unions, too.
Absolutely, and that tends to depend more on the industry because there are some industries.
Exactly, the steel workers and the IBEW.
Right. Right.
You know, they do what they want, but like with the food and commercial workers, the big change in that was when they started to part time and they paid the same union dues and benefits, but the union dues, but didn't really receive the benefit. They were scaled down, and there was like, then the hours were enacted, 24 hours is part-time, we don't have to pay.
Right.
And that thing's just
but
getting
see,
out of
those
control.
Were the, those were the result of laws that were passed.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, but, and thank you for bringing that to my attention, but the point still remains that those unions are driven by the masses into the union, and they get the union dues for the people, but they can't really bargain for them because of those laws.
Well, and so the laws need to be changed. What we need is a Department of Labor like Robert Reich, you know, bring him back. We need a Department of Labor that's aggressively advocating for the working people, and we need to pass laws that say that even part-time people are entitled to at least some benefits.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service right after this and take more of your calls as well. 45 minutes past the hour. Slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I would call you prolific.
Prolific? Oh, because I said
I'm just.
I have a new book out. You mean?
Yeah. so in admiration.
Well,
of you.
This is actually the Tom Hartman Reader. It's actually a collection of other things. You know, it's like the best of from the 22 books that I printed before this, but published.
Yeah.
And Ty Moses was the editor at Barrett Kohler, who went through and read all 22 of my books and pulled out what she thought were the best chapters and actually wrote some introductions for them. And when I said I'm really pleased with it, what I meant was I'm really pleased with the work that Ty did in making me look good. But it's great. It's a great collection. It's kind of the best, the Tom Hartman Reader. It just came out. It's just out.
It's a great idea. It's a very cool idea.
Yeah. So what's going on in the world?
Well, passed the American Jobs Bill is so last week.
Oh, really?
This week, it's We Can't Wait.
Okay.
That is what the president will be shouting today or saying today as he kicks off his latest tour, this one of the West Coast and of the West, as he goes to Las Vegas and to Nevada before he heads off to Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And the administration has announced today new terms for a federal mortgage refinancing program to help homeowners facing foreclosure. Now, as you know, they've had a number of ideas about helping people with their housing problems, and they've been criticized, actually, for not being bold enough.
Mm-hmm.
They hope that this time they may have hit the jackpot, to use a Las Vegas phrase.
Yeah.
Nevada is the state with the nation's highest foreclosure rate, and Obama's expected to promote new rules for federally guaranteed mortgages to homeowners so that those with little or no equity in their homes can refinance and avoid foreclosure. Now, according to Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan today, he says borrowers could save more than $2,500 a year. It's the equivalent of a substantial tax cut for these families, he says.
Wow.
And basically what they're going to do is they're going to loosen the terms of the existing home affordable refinance program that has failed to deliver the number of refinancings initially expected because it was just complicated.
Right.
The problem is, and this is what some people are already starting to criticize, is that HARP, as it's known, aids those who've been making on-time mortgage payments but have been unable to secure refinancing at a lower rate due to the dropping rate value of their home. Of course, one of the difficulties with many people is that their payments have not been on time.
Right.
So it doesn't help those people, but they do think it's going to help a large number of people. Asked what the large number of people was, Gene Sperling, a member of the administration, wouldn't say.
Right. And I can tell you the Republican, I know my right-wing radio colleagues well enough to know right now what they're going to say. Oh, he's trying to reinflate the housing bubble to bring back good times so he can get himself elected. And if he does that, he's just going to set up another burst in the bubble. And the reality is that if these mortgages are allowed to be tranched and securitized so that the banks can take $1 billion worth of mortgages and turn them into $50 trillion worth of CDOs, then that's true. But if this is just a federal backstop and the federal government is not tranching and securitizing these loans, then that's absolutely not true. So if I'm making sense.
Yeah, no, you're making total sense.
Okay.
Couple of interesting quick ones. The head of Libya's interim government today announced the creation of a formal committee of inquiry to examine the circumstances surrounding the death of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi while in custody of his captors, saying as it seems, due to cell phone videos, that he was not shot in the head during crossfire.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. But what we don't know is exactly what kind of authority this panel has, this committee has, and actually what kind of consequences there might be for anybody who is, it turns up, might have been somebody who's done it. And he also suggested a new explanation for how Gaddafi died, suggesting his own men may have killed him so that he wouldn't implicate them in his litany of atrocities.
Oh, that's interesting. That's not inconceivable, too.
It's not inconceivable.
Yeah. The good news out of this, it seems to me, Victoria, is that the people running Libya now are talking about the rule of law.
They are talking about the rule of law. I think what is a little concerning to some people was the emphasis yesterday on Islamic law and on it being a country of law of Islam. And you didn't get the impression from the people in the crowds that that was really where they were at.
Right.
So we'll see how that shakes out.
Yeah.
Meantime, very interesting from the Vatican today, a proposal by the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace calls for a new world economic order based on ethics and the achievement of a universal common good.
Holy cow. The Republicans have to be hysterical.
I think they will be. It basically says that we need a radical reform of the world's financial systems, including the creation of a global political authority to manage the economy.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like we have the Sherman Antitrust Act in the United States that breaks up these big corporations. But now the corporations are transnational and they're so large internationally, we really do need an international Sherman Antitrust Act.
Well, I mean, that is where we're moving. We are a global economy, and some of these things will have to be international. It's interesting the Vatican is proposing that.
Yeah.
It will be met kicking and screaming by banksters.
Yes.
Yes. By some. Yes. Yes. It's really quite radical. It calls for a minimum shared body of rules to manage the global financial market, lamenting the overall abrogation of controls on capital movements. And it criticizes an economic liberalism that spurns rules and controls, attacks utilitarian thinking, saying that what is useful to the individual does not always favor the common good.
Right. And they're using liberalism in the European sense of libertarianism, basically, rather than the American sense.
Exactly. Exactly. Julian Assange, WikiLeaks founder today, says that financial problems may lead to the closure of WikiLeaks at the end of this year, saying if WikiLeaks does not find a way to remove this blockade, we will simply not be able to continue by the turn of the new year. The blockade is one imposed by financial companies, including Visa, MasterCard, Western Union, and PayPal.
Hmm. Okay.
They can't get any cash. They're going to fundraise and stop publishing.
Yeah, I think that's so wrong that that's being done to them. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, through the course of the day, we've heard reports from Occupy Seattle, Occupy San Francisco, Occupy Minneapolis, Occupy Windsor, Canada, Occupy Detroit, Occupy... Actually, I mean, you just from planned interviews to people spontaneously calling in. But it all began in Wall Street with this call from Adbuster saying, let's occupy Wall Street. And then it just took on a life of its own. And it's very, very interesting how the New York Police Department, which has taken a multi-million dollar gift from one of the big banks, Jamie Rubin's, I believe, Citibank, and who is arguably working under the supervision of a billionaire mayor, certainly part of the 1%, and whose live-in girlfriend, the mayor, is on the board of the company or is affiliated in some way with the company that owns and runs the park that's being occupied, Zuccotti Park. It's just really interesting to see how all this is playing out. And for the latest on it, Donna Lieberman is with us. She's the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, the NYCLU, the Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU of New York State. The website is nyclu.org. Donna, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So Mayor Bloomberg, Commissioner Kelly, the police in general, what's going on there?
You know, I think that the review on the police is a definite mixed bag. You know, they've done some pretty outrageous things, you know, the mass arrests on the Brooklyn Bridge, the pepper spray. But I think the good news, the goodest news that we're seeing is that they made a decision to not interfere, and they probably had no choice in that, with the right of the Occupy Wall Street to stay in Zuccotti Park. You know, 24/7. That's huge. You know, we're still fighting for the protesters to be able to have tents to protect them from the elements, and to set up porta potties so that people, you know, don't end up answering nature's call in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, those are only reasonable things. I'm curious. Are you an attorney?
I am.
Okay. I'm curious. I'm not. And you know, I kind of, the law is a hobby, but I certainly don't represent myself as an expert on it. I've written a couple of books about some very, very narrow pieces of it on which I can probably out-debate any lawyer. But generally speaking, I'm curious. The First Amendment protects the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. And arguably, that's exactly what is happening in this park. The Supreme Court over many years in a variety of decisions has narrowed that right. Famously, I think it was in the 1940s or 50s when one of the justices brought into being the cliche about the right to yell fire in a crowded theater. You could probably correct me on which decision that was. How constitutional is what is being done? I mean, is it true that people could say my permit is the First Amendment of the Constitution?
Well, you know, as with all rights, you know, nothing is absolutely inflexible and not subject to a certain amount of government regulation. And the principle with regard to the First Amendment is that the government is able to engage in reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions, but it can't base any restrictions on the content of what's being said, and it can't be unreasonable, and it has to take a least restrictive approach to First Amendment rights. You know, that's the constitutional principle, and there are, you know, laws that vary from, you know, one city or town to the next about exactly what you need to do. What's important in New York, among other things, is that while you need a permit to protest in the street, you don't need a permit to walk on the sidewalk, to demonstrate on the sidewalk, as long as you keep, you know, a pedestrian aisle open. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have often gotten into disputes with the police about getting permits to march in the street, and Occupy Wall Street says, we're not getting permits. We don't believe in permits for protests. We're protesting, and we'll do it within the law. And so they've been having sidewalk demonstrations, occasionally spilling out into the street, you know, constantly. Mm-hmm. And in New York, you don't need a permit. What you do need a permit for is sound, and they've been denied a permit for sound up until now. One hopes that as the drumming controversy gets under control, it would be possible for them to get sound. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that's going on, Tom, and if we could talk more about the permit stuff before getting into this, is the surveillance of what's going on.
Yeah, that's
the
thing that I find most troubling, is the police are coming in, if I understand this correctly, police are coming in with video cameras, video and sound cameras, and virtually 24/7, virtually every person, everything that's said, being videotaped. Do I have that right?
Well, it seems So, of course, when it comes to video surveillance by the NYPD, nobody knows exactly what they're doing. We can only surmise, because if there were a prize for the most opaque government agency in the country, I think the NYPD would probably run a close second to the CIA. It might even take over first place.
Well, are they, so they're not being intrusive? They're not, like, walking into the middle with a video camera and just holding it up?
No, I didn't say that.
Okay. No, I'm just reading the news stories, and from reading the news stories, I got the sense that they were actually being intrusive, that there was an intimidating presence of oversight, or whatever you call it, snoopiness.
Yeah, and, let's not call it oversight.
Yeah,
oversight connotes.
That's
good.
The totally wrong word. Yes, you're absolutely right.
What happens?
Surveillance
is
the word I was looking for.
Right. Yeah. What happened? There's a group called CARU, T-A-R-U, within the police department, and that's the techno squad from the NYPD, and they show up with their video cameras. So, in addition to all the normal video surveillance that goes on that block and in that neighborhood, as a routine matter, CARU shows up. They sit on their truck, they're on the ground, whenever there's a demonstration, and they whoop out their video cameras. And what we have ourselves, witnessed, because we have protesters, we have observers, at every major demonstration, threatened confrontation, is that if you train your camera on CARU, well, what do you know? They take pictures of you. And that's not what they're supposed to be doing. Theoretically, what they're allowed to do and what the police department is allowed to videotape is they're allowed to videotape a demonstration, but only for the purposes of crowd control and making decisions about how to police things.
Right.
Not for the purposes, very most definitely, not for the purposes of establishing and maintaining personal dossiers on protesters.
Right. Although there's a long history there. Donna Lieberman, we have 30 seconds left. What's the ACLU doing about this in New York, ACLU?
We're giving out our Know Your Rights material. Our legal observers are on the scene constantly, and we're collecting stories by email at protest@nyclu.org. People can go to our website nyclu.org to find out more. But we're on the scene, and we want to know about problems that people have in participating in Occupy Wall Street. This is an important movement, and the right to protest is what we're about.
Great. So those listening to us on WWRL in New York, or watching us on Manhattan Neighborhood Networks or Dish Network, DirecTV, we're actually on a couple of cable systems in New York. However, if you're involved, get over to nyclu.org. Check it out. Thank you, Donna.
Thanks so much, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Wow. So where is the right to protest? And where are we at with that? Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. Check out the hashtag OCT29, OCT29, the Enough is Enough rally at the U.S. Capitol, noon to 6 p.m. This is 12 noon to 6 a.m. Is it going to be overnight? I'm not sure. It's going to be overnight. Thank you, Jacob. And I'll be speaking, kicking off the rally at noon. So if you're here in Washington, D.C. next Saturday, show up. It should be a lot of fun. And again, it's hashtag OCT29. So October 29. Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just wanted to talk about a little bit of healthcare issues today, but dealing with that bomb in Maine there in the tent, I was on the internet today on MSN, and I didn't see anything about it.
Yeah.
I may have missed it, but I didn't see anything.
Well, that's the thing. I doubt you'll see it anywhere, and it's because, partly it's because our media is, muck news, it's infotainment. But probably more importantly, it's because the Tea Party was so effective at getting so much publicity that was way out of proportion to their size and influence, because they had billionaires who were hiring, you know, millions of dollars for the public relations.
Exactly. One question: have you ever heard of a gentleman by the name of Wendell Potter?
I know Wendell Potter personally.
Oh, terrific!
Yeah, he's been on this show many times. He's been on our TV show a number of times. Carl Wolfson, who is the fellow who replaced me on the local show on KPOJ, AM 620 KPOJ in Portland, and does one of the very best local progressive talk shows in America out of KPOJ. You can listen to it in the morning from 6 to 9 a.m. Pacific time. I guess that would be 9 a.m. to noon. Anyhow, Carl went to college with Wendell, which is how I met Wendell through Carl. And Wendell was coming on the show to be, you know, Carl invited him on the show. And this was back before Wendell was, you know, the kind of famous front guy before his, I think he has a book out now. And he was just saying, hey, you know, yeah, I used to work at Cigna, I think it was, or Aetna.
I'm glad that he's been on your show. I wanted to share with you is I live in an age-restricted community in the Phoenix area here, and we have a lot of snowbirds, you know, which are people from the north and Canadians and stuff that come down here who have winter second homes here. And over the course of the last 2-3 years, I started to speak with them about their healthcare system. And I spoke with about 16 to 17 different families and people on it.
From Canada.
To my utter amazement, only one had anything slightly negative to say about it.
Yeah.
Everyone else was pretty positive. They did say, which is very good.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And you can, in most provinces, you can buy supplemental policies if you're rich and you want to have, you know, instant access to things like, you know, hip replacement surgery, where otherwise you may have to wait a few months because that's not critical care. But if you're sick, you get instant care just like that. And if you've got a slow or long-term problem that can be dealt with over time, it will get dealt with, and it will get dealt with in a reasonable period of time. And they deliver health care to everybody in the country from cradle to grave at half the cost that we do here in the United States, because they don't have any, not one, health care billionaires in Canada, whereas we've got
like
a bunch
of insurance industry. I shouldn't have said I was amazed, because I was not. Those were the wrong choice of words. But the other thing is, even if you're lucky enough to be covered under a group plan or whatever, as you know, open enrollment is coming right around the corner here pretty soon.
Oh yeah.
And I got a feeling deductibles are going to be rising. Copays may be rising.
Sure, they change the plans every year. You know, every year it's like, how can we squeeze an extra 2% out of the people and 2% out of the employers and 3% out of the docs and because these guys, you know, like Stephen Hemsley, the old CEO of United Healthcare, making more than $400 million. I mean, as a CEO, his predecessor, Dollar Bill McGuire, making $1.7 billion as the CEO of a health insurance company. In Canada, their income would be zero. There is no, you know, there are, it's crazy. Steve, thank you for the call, and thanks for raising that issue. Karen in Abbeville, South Carolina. Karen, welcome to the program. Karen, you are on the air. Oh, my. Karen had been on hold for a long time. I'm sorry, Karen. Cindy in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Cindy, what's up?
Hi, this is concerning the unbelievable Citizens United decision.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say that when I voted for Obama, I voted in concert with my hands, my feet, my heart, and my brain. And though most corporations, perhaps, you know, all the corrupt corporations are basically totalitarian regimes, for them to exist as a citizen in a constitutional democracy, they must provide and abide by the decision of a private plebiscite or vote of all employees before embarking or on promoting or opposing any candidate or issue. I think that's only fair.
In other words, you're saying that before a corporation gives penny one to Karl Rove to run campaign ads against Democrats, every single person working for that corporation should have a vote in whether or not that money is used that way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, that's how it works in unions, because unions are democracies. You know, unions are democratic institutions.
Right. But if they want to exist as a citizen in a democracy, then they have to work in concert just as every citizen does.
It would be nice, Cindy, but the fact is that corporations aren't democracies. Corporations are kingdoms.
I know they are. Absolutely. I've worked for quite a few.
Yeah.
Not now, and I haven't in 10 years because I refuse to work for them anymore.
Yeah. Well, what this does is it highlights the absurdity of the Supreme Court. And also, we need to keep emphasizing it over and over and over again. No legislature in the history of America, no House of Representatives, no Congress, and no Senate at the federal level or at the state level has ever said corporations are people and money is speech. No president has ever said corporations are money and persons and money is speech.
It takes away a lot of speech from a lot of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And only the Supreme Court has done this, Cindy. This is how corrupt the Supreme Court is with their idea of judicial supremacy and judicial review. And frankly, it needs to be challenged, and it can be challenged according to the Constitution by Congress. They should be doing it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the insanely ugly. End your calls. Right. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very humectantly ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, anonymous. The hacktivist group took a break from rooting out and demonstrating against corporate corruption to take down a child porn ring on the internet. What they call Operation Darknet, anonymous claims it took down a website containing over 100 gigs of child porn and made public the names of nearly 1,600 users on the website. Anonymous is now targeting a company that it alleges, either knowingly or not, was hosting the child porn site, as well as other similar sites known as Freedom Hosting. Whether it's lending support to Occupy Wall Street, uncovering corporate crimes, or busting up child porn rings, Anonymous is filling the void left by other institutions that seem to have forgotten how to do their jobs. The bad. The TSA. Not only should the Transportation Security Administration keep its hands to itself with all the groin checks, but it needs to keep its lewd comments to itself, too. When writer Jill Filipovic arrived at her hotel room, she opened her bag and found one of those TSA notes informing her that an agent had randomly searched it. Apparently, during that random search, the agent also found a personal item of Filipovic's, one that vibrates. So the agent decided to personalize the TSA notification letter with their own comment, writing on the back of the paper in big letters, "Get your freak on, girl!" Exclamation point. Jill called the note wildly inappropriate. Just when you thought the TSA couldn't be more perverse. And the very, very ugly Brian Kilmeade. While most war-weary Americans are thrilled to hear that troops are coming home from Iraq at the end of the year, talking head over at Fox So-Called News, Brian Kilmeade isn't. Today he asked if President Obama's decision could mean that the lives of the 4,000-plus soldiers who died there were, quote, wasted, end quote. Kilmeade said, "Have all our blood and money been wasted if we don't find a way to leave Iraq in peace? You owe it to those who've already lost their lives and been wounded in battle to try to win this thing. 4,549 Americans have been killed in Iraq. If this goes afoul, could their lives be wasted?" End quote. I get it. Fox So-Called News wants to deny President Obama the foreign policy achievement of winding down the Iraq war. That's fine. That's what they do. But to drag in dead American soldiers, to say that ending an illegal war might render lost lives wasted, that's a new low. We should all be able to agree that bringing soldiers home is a good thing. And losing one more soldier in a war that doesn't need to be fought would be the true tragedy. Fox So-Called News. Very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Devin in Blattsburg, Virginia. Hey, Devin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I wanted to talk about this Occupy effort and how it's being co-opted in some instances by the Department of Defense via local public universities. I remember when I was an undergraduate that we actually protested Star Wars research money coming to ASU. Mm-hmm. And now the Department of Defense and Virginia Tech are so intertwined, it's kind of hard to believe. They had an Occupy Tech gig on a Thursday, and then on a Saturday, Occupy Blacksburg. And except for one woman, every single person who spoke was either a professor or a Virginia Tech student. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk on behalf of my group about the Radford Army Ammunition Plant, mm-hmm. my group being environmental advocates of the New River Valley, but somehow they didn't have room on the schedule for me to speak because all those tech professors needed to have the mic.
And yeah, or it was their club and they wanted it to be their club. I mean, let's cut them a little slack.
Well, but that's not what Occupy, the Occupy movement is not about clubs. It's about the people. And
arguably. Arguably. I think that each movement probably takes on its own nature and character. But I get your point, Devin. And I know your passion about the environmental pollution from the give me the name again.
Radford Army Ammunition Plant.
Thank you. And you've called about it before, and I honor the work that you're doing, and please keep doing it. And do you have a website for people who want more information?
We have this Facebook page going, and I'm hoping someone's going to help me set up a website.
Okay. And the Facebook page is?
Environmental Advocates of the New River Valley.
Great. Okay. So at least your voice was heard here, Devin. Thank you very much
yes.
for the call. I've got to move along. I appreciate the call from you. Karen in Abbeville, South Carolina. Hey, Karen, what's up?
Hey, yes, American Dream of Becoming a Team, and I love your program.
Thank you.
Yes. The saying has been around for decades, of the people, by the people, for the people. Do I have it in the right order?
I don't remember, but close enough.
I don't talk to people about memories because I can't remember to.
Okay.
Okay. Now, it's going to be changing, or if it hasn't already, it'll be of the poor people by the puppet politicians for the criminal profiteers.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Very well said.
Thank you. Thank
Karen,
you. You're brilliant.
Okay. Well, Karen, thank you for the call, and thank you very much.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. Tim in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking the call, and hope to see you Saturday downtown.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Look forward to it. You mused earlier, you wonder where freedom of speech is going. I'm wondering what your take was on the Wisconsin Assembly ushering out the folks who simply put signs on themselves when they went in and sat up in the space to watch what was going on. Didn't say a word, acted perfectly fine. There's videos of them just being taken out by the police.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's WikiLeaks now unable to engage in their business. They're being shut down. And Anonymous, by the way, is attacking back by threatening to take Fox News off. It's a good question that you raised or mused, and I just wanted to get your further thoughts on it.
I don't know the details of the Wisconsin protest that you're talking about, so I can't speak to it. I just don't. But the with regard to the WikiLeaks thing, I think it's this is something that probably more people need to know. And thank you for the call. More people need to know about, and it's one of the reasons that we highlighted it today. And that is that Julian Assange is saying that WikiLeaks may cease to exist at the end of the year because they're running out of money. And why are they running out of money? Because if you want to go to WikiLeaks website and contribute money to them, you can't do it using MasterCard, Visa, or PayPal because all of those organizations have joined in saying that they will not participate in allowing you to make a contribution to WikiLeaks. And I just think that's so wrong. You can make a contribution. These organizations, I don't know for a fact that you can make a contribution to the American Nazi Party or the American Communist Party, but I'd be astounded if you couldn't through one of them. I mean, who said that it's the job of banksters to be making moral decisions about whose cash they're going to process? I mean, these banks have over and over and over again been busted for criminally laundering the money of, like, drug cartels. In fact, the drug cartels couldn't function in this country without these banksters. But they're gonna go after WikiLeaks? I mean, it just is so wrong. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Let's have this debate, Tom.
You and me?
Okay. One of the best kept secrets about our country and our taxation, and one of the most distorted aspects of it from the billionaire mainstream media, is the reason the wealthiest in this country pay the most disproportionate share of the tax is because they absolutely keep the most benefit from taxation on a personal level,
sure.
Economically.
Sure.
And that's what these people out here that don't have the ability to think outside of one dimension and are constantly repetitiously fed distortions from Limbaugh, Fox, and all the other corporate, quote, fascists, okay, the trickle-nomics fascists, they don't understand it because they're not bad people. They haven't been educated and taught how it works.
Yeah. No, I think Armin, you're absolutely right that the average American doesn't realize all the tax shelters available to rich people. And they're not just rich people. You know, General Electric last year was incredibly profitable, paid no U.S. income tax. The most profitable corporation on earth, ExxonMobil, is arguably an American company. And showed I believe it was like a $400 billion profit or something, some amazing amount of profit, and maybe it was $40 billion, and paid no income tax. So, the largest corporations in America, the richest wealth individuals in America, figure out ways not to pay income tax. You're absolutely right. Beth in San Jose. Hey, Beth, what's up?
Tom, on this WikiLeaks embargo,
yeah.
I wanted to ask you how this embargo is not a violation of our First Amendment rights, because it was not, in fact, started by these financial institutions themselves. It was started by our government in response to Cablegate.
So you're saying that our government asked these financial institutions not to accept monies from WikiLeaks?
They absolutely did. In other words, well, we know that the State Department sent out a letter, a mass letter.
Yeah.
We know.
No, I remember that. That happened in the last
remember
year of the Bush administration.
So,
yes.
But
the government did not force them to.
Well, we don't know that, do we?
Well, okay, you may be right.
Beth,
you're absolutely right. If the government forced these agencies not to process money for WikiLeaks, then that is, in my opinion, I agree with you, it's a violation of the First Amendment. If not, it's just, because the First Amendment doesn't protect us from corporate activity, or each other. It's not a violation of the law. Thank
you,
Beth.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
WikiLeaks, free speech, more on that. Stick around.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
You tell him, Leonard. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Jack in Goebbels, Michigan. Hey, Jack, what's up?
How you doing? I would just like to point out that I Googled national debt by president.
Mm-hmm.
And several sites came up. One of them was a Wikipedia site, but others had the same information. And it shows that figured as a percentage of GDP since the end of World War II, every Democratic president has actually reduced our national debt. Every Republican president, except possibly Eisenhower and Nixon, has increased our national debt as a percentage of GDP.
Yes.
And if Reagan and the two Bushes had never been elected, we would not now have a significant national debt. And I never hear about this in the news. I just wonder why this is always overlooked.
you're absolutely right. Jack, thank you for the call and well said. And it could be that you're not hearing about it in the news because the news has a Republican bias. It inherently has a Republican bias. The Republicans would never get elected if big news, big media didn't have a Republican bias. If they didn't have, it's really interesting. Media Matters did an analysis. It might have been Center for American Progress, I think progress.org, did an analysis of during the Bush administration, how often Republicans were showing up on the Sunday programs, on the Sunday news shows, the Face the Nation, Meet the Press kind of shows. And it was well over 50%, and yet the Republicans are about half, right, in Congress and in power and whatnot. And when they were confronted, when these news organizations were confronted, they said, well, the Republicans are in power, so of course, because they have power, we're going to want to talk to them more, which, makes a certain amount of sense. So then President Obama becomes president, and still the Republicans are more than 50% on the Sunday shows. So they go back to them and say, well, you know, why don't you have Democrats 50-50 with the Republicans? Or for that matter, why don't you have voices that are independent of either party? You know, the Amy Goodmans of the world, the Katrina Vandenhoevels, the people who are the Michael Moores who, you know, maybe they lean Democratic, but, you know, they're really not partisans, generally speaking. And the answer that they got was, well, the Republicans are out of power now, so they need to be highlighted because they're out of power. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Heads I win, tails you lose? I mean, really? Is that really how it's supposed to be? So, you know, that's the best answer I can give you, the best explanation. I don't have a, you know, it's, anyhow, David in Seattle. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, the most important message for this Occupy movement is the fact that nobody talked about careers. Everybody talked about jobs. Now, jobs will last 1 to 5 years, and they disappear. But careers are 20 or 30 or longer years. And the trade unionism was infiltrated in 1940 to stop the trade unionism that would create careers. In other words, they would be involved with trade unionism, would be involved with the community colleges and the universities.
Yep.
And we went to a capitalistic system after 1940 because it was infiltrated. So what I'm saying is the message should be careers, not just jobs.
Yeah.
That's what I want to get out there.
Okay.
I want to hear more careers all the time.
Yeah, you did it very well, David, and spot on. I don't know about any infiltration of the union movement. I do know that in 1947, in the election of 46, the Republicans took both the House and the Senate. The president was Harry Truman, and they passed this horrible piece of legislation called Taft-Hartley, which allowed states to opt out of the Wagner Act, out of the National Labor Relations Act, and become right-to-work-for-less states. And that was the beginning. That was the peak of unionization, 35% in 1947, and it's been on a downhill slope ever since, although it went steeply downhill since Ronald Reagan busted PATCO and went on the warpath against unions. And you are absolutely right. I mean, my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. The guys in that shop who were journeyman toolmakers or tool and die makers were literally, that was a career and a very well paid one, by the way. I mean, you know, I don't mean very well paid like rich, but good, solid middle class jobs. And we do need to go back to a manufacturing based economy. It's now 11% of our economy. It was 35% of our economy when my dad was working. And we need to go back to that. Rick in Boston. Hey, Rick, what's up?
How are you, young fellow?
Fine. What's on your mind?
I'm a veteran with an honorable discharge. I need to ask you one quick, simple, blunt question.
Yeah.
Is the Iranians a threat to U.S. or Israeli security? And can you elaborate on anything that you might know or might not know?
Sure.
And I'll take your. I don't know how to go about this because.
Yeah. Here's my real simple answer. Here's my real simple answer, Rick. To the best of my knowledge, first of all, Iran is not a threat to us. They're not going to be able to come and get us.
How about when we pull out of Iraq?
Well, you know, the biggest bank in Baghdad is already the Iranian bank. The Iranian, basically, George Bush handed Iraq over to the Shia. And Iran and Iraq have already developed an alliance. There used to be a Sunni Shia, Saddam Hussein. The reason we supported him in the war against Iran, where 1 million people died on both sides, and the reason why we supported Saddam Hussein in that was to have that Sunni blockade against Iran. Now Iran has a lot more influence in the region as a result of George Bush's policies. Whether they're a threat to Israel, Israel has nukes. Israel, I don't think that any country in that region would be stupid enough to seriously take on Israel. And if they did, they would get vaporized, and they know it. You know, Pakistan has had nukes all these years, and, you know, it's not like, oh, my God, Pakistan, you know, an Islamic nation, has nukes. Let's take them out tomorrow. So, frankly, apparently, the Israelis put
one,
a worm into the...
One of my big fears is the only thing we're going to have in Iraq is 160 soldiers, you know, with the U.S. embassy.
Yeah.
Are we in danger, those 160 guys... Are we in danger because we're pulling out?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think that we're much safer, frankly. And thank God we're pulling out. Coming up tomorrow, I'll speak with law professor David Moran of the University of Michigan about the latest on America's police state. Michigan drivers facing drug checkpoints? What? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, show up, occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.